This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 25th, 2002. I'm Julie Hay, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. Thousands descend on the nation's capital to protest the upcoming IMF World Bank meetings. A subway workers' strike in London strands 3 million commuters. Abner Louima defendant Charles Schwartz agrees to a plea bargain. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Colombian President Alvaro Uribe met with President George Bush in D.C. today and asked for additional assistance.
We need the support of your country, the support of your government, your personal support for my country to solve problems of violence, economic and social problems.
Colombia is already getting more than $300 million in military aid from the United States. But as Nikki Carson reports from Bogota, there are constant conflicts of interest between the military, Colombia, and the United States government.
2 days ago, the Attorney General released drug trafficking indictments against 3 members of the right-wing United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia. One indictment is against Carlos Castaño, the press-savvy leader of this paramilitary group, who has always been open about his involvement in drug trafficking. In his book, My Confessions, published last December, he explicitly recounts his relations with Pablo Escobar and the Cali cartel. Luis Guillermo Perez of the International Federation of Human Rights says that President Alvaro Uribe Vélez should already have a capture order out for Castaño, not exclusively for drug trafficking, but for his involvement in more than 70 massacres. But since the president is offering millions of pesos in rewards for the capture of guerrilla leaders and not AUC leaders, Perez says it is unlikely that the Colombian authorities will detain the 3 AUC leaders being indicted by the U.S. Nicole Carson in Bogota for Free Speech Radio News.
Tensions are high again in the Indian state of Gujarat. Vinod Kijos reports from New Delhi.
More than 6,000 military personnel are deployed in the eastern state of Gujarat, and there is widespread apprehension in the country of communal tension flaring up again. Yesterday evening, 2 gunmen entered Akshartham temple complex belonging to India's wealthiest Hindu sect, the Swami Narayan, situated on the outskirts of Gandhinagar city in Gujarat state. The Hindu right-wing organizations Vishwa Hindu Parishad and Bajrang Dal have declared a nationwide shutdown on tomorrow, protesting yesterday's attack on a temple in Gujarat. In the indiscriminate firing, 30 people were killed and 40 injured. The Gujarat state minister said that no organization had claimed responsibility for the attacks so far. Speaking at a press conference in Ahmedabad, VHP International General Secretary Praveen Tagodia said, "The VHP is calling on the Hindus of India to protest in a democratic way. I am not an astrologer. Anything can happen tomorrow." He also demanded India should attack Pakistan in the manner the United States did to Taliban following the September 11 tragedy. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Navy is now using several weapons systems that have not been fully tested. And at least one Pentagon official, Thomas Christie, says he's concerned. More from Jay Tamboli in D.C.
In a letter to Navy Secretary Gordon England, Christie said that he was concerned about an apparent trend by the Navy to deploy combat systems that have not demonstrated acceptable performance during operational test and evaluation. One of the weapons mentioned is the Joint Standoff Weapon, used on F-A-18 Super Hornet fighter jets. The Pentagon says that it is Navy practice to complete testing prior to deployment, but in times when weapons are needed expeditiously, there may be exceptions. In this case, they said the risks were evaluated and considered acceptable, but the situation may be indicative of a general trend. Inadequate testing of the V-22 Osprey aircraft led to the death of 23 Marines 2.5 years ago. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, this is Jay Tamboli.
A federal judge in Vermont ruled the death penalty is unconstitutional. While the decision is relatively narrow, opponents of the death penalty are advancing their cause. Amanda Gustafson reports from WGDR in Vermont.
Vermont Federal Court Judge William Sessions made the ruling in the case of 22-year-old Donald Fell, who was accused of the murder of Tereska King 2 years ago. Judge Sessions argued that the federal death penalty statute is unconstitutional because it doesn't allow for the cross-examination of witnesses by the defense. His ruling will only directly affect the case of Donald Fell, although it is expected to have an effect on other cases where the death penalty is being sought. Judge Sessions' ruling lends momentum to another Vermonter interested in death penalty reform, Senator Patrick Leahy. The senator introduced the Innocence Protection Act in February of 2000. The act seeks to improve due process protections provided to defendants by guaranteeing DNA testing, providing competent legal services, compensating unjustly incarcerated individuals, and educating the public on the administration of the death penalty. Reporting from WGDR in Plainfield, Vermont, I'm Amanda Gustafson for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The first in a series of threatened strikes brought chaos to London today. A walkout by subway workers affected 3 million commuters, and a looming firefighter strike could affect even more. This wave of industrial action ends a relatively strike-free era and marks the rise of a new generation of militant unionists. London Mayor Ken Livingstone came out to condemn the strike. Charlotte Parsons reports from London.
This is an absolute disgrace. This is a completely unnecessary strike.
Today, London has been brought to a standstill. A subway strike over pay has caused commuter chaos and cost more than $80 million in lost output. Another strike is planned for next week. And that's not the end of it. The nation's entire public transport system, including the trains connecting England to France, may have to be shut down for safety reasons when the country's firemen walk off the job. A long era of virtually no strikes has come to an end, and a winter of discontent for the government has begun. Tony Blair and his Labour Party used to enjoy a close relationship with the unions, but no more. A new generation of militant unionists have been calling on members to take to the streets. Union boss John Edmonds says the problem lies with the government, that the Blair administration has shifted to the right.
We are looking for some substantial changes in policy by this Labour government, and we become increasingly concerned that the Labour government has positioned itself much closer to the Conservative government under Thatcher and Major. It was a terrible period, and we're not looking to return to that.
And as the government moves to the right, the new radical union leadership shifts further left, widening the gap. The Prime Minister used to have close allies among the union leaders, but in recent months, his allies have been ousted and replaced with hardliners. Roger Lyons of manufacturing union Amicus says the trouble started when the Prime Minister tried too hard to prove that he is not controlled by the unions that funded his election.
Tony Blair and his cabinet felt that they had to show that they weren't puppets on a string, and that means that they may have gone too far the other way and angered a lot of trade unionists by appearing to give the employers a red carpet entry into Downing Street.
Today's strike is all about pay, but money isn't the only bone of contention. Labour organisation bosses are also fighting government proposals to increase the role of private sector services in running schools and hospitals. There is also a row over pensions. The powerful rail workers' union has warned it may strike over the closure of final pension schemes. Roger Lyon believes some of the more radical union leaders could go too far and end up alienating the very people they claim to represent.
There are some unions, particularly in the public services, that have elected people who will be closer to revolutionary Trotskyists, but they tend to be in very small unions. There are some people, particularly the Civil Service Union, which now has a Trotskyist as the new General Secretary, that may well cause upsets for the government. And I think the members will get fed up with being used if that turns out to be the way it develops. There's certainly no growth in support for revolutionary Trotskyism amongst civil servants.
But it looks like it will take time and more strikes before the rift between the Labour government and the Labour movement is healed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charlotte Parsons in London.
Thousands of protesters are already descending on the nation's capital for this weekend's meetings of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Protesters say the World Bank and IMF are undemocratic institutions and that their policies are fueling a worldwide epidemic of corporate greed. D.C. police now appear to be backing down from a threat to use federal racketeering laws on the protesters. Josh Chaffin reports from Washington.
Even the diehards in the activist community complain the issues surrounding the World Bank and IMF are vast and confusing, and some people say the movement is unfocused. Hearing those complaints, one of the groups organizing this weekend's protest in D.C. The Mobilization for Global Justice sums up their issues with four demands for the World Bank and the IMF. Here's the group's Kate Lowe.
We want the World Bank and the IMF to open their meetings to the public. We want them to cancel the debt, the whole debt. Countries that have huge debt can't provide health care, good public education. They can't support their environmental programs. We want them to end all structural adjustment policies. Those are policies that open up countries for multinational corporations to go in and extract resources, to go in and abuse labor rights. And we want the World Bank and the IMF to stop funding all socially and environmentally destructive policies, like policies that lead to deforestation, oil mining, and gas projects.
While protesters converge on D.C. from all over the world with stories of disastrous dam projects, governments stealing aid money, and corporate abuses of workers, to activists in D.C., like Zain El Amin, this struggle against the World Bank and the IMF is also a local issue.
We have a budget deficit of $323 million in D.C., and we have these financial institutions of the World Bank and IMF that are exempt from property taxes and income taxes. If they were to pay their property taxes and income taxes, the D.C. would get $57 million that they can use, for example, to stop the slashing of the proposed $30 million cut from the funds for schools.
El Amin is part of a group called the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, which is planning to block D.C. traffic on Friday. The local press is speculating on the possibility of violence, and the Capitol Police threatened this week to use the federal Racketeer-Influenced and Corporate Organizations Statute, or RICO, on anyone who comes from out of state to cause problems. Local civil rights groups were alarmed at first, since the RICO statute was originally intended to help combat the mafia, not protest marchers. But according to Arthur Spitzer, with the local ACLU chapter, the Capitol Police may now have changed their mind.
I think there would be serious problems with trying to apply RICO against protected First Amendment activity. Obviously, breaking windows is not protected First Amendment activity, but I think if the chief got advice from his lawyers that this was not a good idea, that would have been good advice, and I hope that's the advice he got.
The Capitol Police did not return calls from Free Speech Radio News by deadline. The meetings of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund continue through Sunday, as do the protests, which are expected to draw thousands of demonstrators. Josh Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News in the District of Columbia.
Today, Israel continued to ignore international calls to end its siege of Yasser Arafat's compound, while the Palestinians stuck to their refusal to provide Israel with a list of the estimated 200 people inside. Meanwhile, in Ramallah, residents continue to protest the 24-hour-a-day curfew, breaking curfew to converge in the city's main square, banging pots and pans. Meanwhile, Pope John Paul II has joined world leaders in condemning the siege, calling for a suspension of all actions which compromise the already faint hopes for peace in the region. Christian Schur has this report.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres told a gathering of foreign ambassadors in Jerusalem that Palestinian and Israeli officials met in an attempt to end the Israeli attack on Palestinian President Yasser Arafat's compound, which has left all the buildings in the compound destroyed, except for Arafat's office. However, Palestinian cabinet member Saeb Erekat denies that any such meeting took place. A delegate at the UN International Conference of Civil Society in Support of the Palestinian People had this to say about the recent UN Security Council resolution denouncing Israeli violence and its occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, a vote from which the U.S. abstained.
We don't need another resolution. We don't need another letter. We just need them to basically do and deal with those resolutions as they are. We don't need any more resolutions. So we do, again, we do need the letter. Even though it's good to write to President Bush and tell him, don't send any more money to Israel, I don't think he's going to read your letter. But I think Kofi Annan should read our letter, should read our statement, that run the United Nations the way it needs to be run, and don't let the United States run the United Nations.
There are 44 UN Security Council resolutions denouncing the Israeli occupation already on the books. In spite of the Oslo Accords and the more than 20 UN Security Council resolutions specifically demanding that Israel cease all settlement activity, another illegal settlement housing 100 Israelis was created outside of the besieged Palestinian city of Nablus, whose residents are nearing their 100th day under curfew. Israeli officials were invited to partake in celebrating. Deputy Director of the UN Development Program of Assistance to the Palestinian People, Waleed Badawi, says that Israeli closures of Palestinian cities, including Ramallah, make it impossible for his organization to survey the damage of their development projects.
Right now, I think the issue is access. That is the mobility and access of first and foremost Palestinians to be able to move around, and then second, for our work, the access of our staff and our suppliers and our contractors to be able to get into project sites and to do the work that they're supposed to do. I think that's the biggest stumbling block by any account, because of the closures, because of the checkpoints, because of the curfews, because of the occupation. Yeah.
Palestinians like Haweda Araf say that settlements like Rahalim further obstruct Palestinian access to their own cities, towns, schools, and jobs, adding to the daily humiliation that Palestinians suffer.
Tonight, Ramallah and all Palestinian cities are still under siege. President Arafat's compound is still surrounded, and Ariel Sharon is demanding that President Arafat turn over more of the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian people. They've already arrested thousands, and they are demanding more in a ridiculous call for an occupied people to provide for the protection of the occupiers, with no guarantee whatsoever and no indication that Israel plans to end this occupation. And sadly, the international community, and specifically America, is silently endorsing.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kristen Scher.
This past weekend, the Abner Louima police brutality case finally came to an end. Ex-cop Charles Schwartz agreed to plead guilty to one count of perjury. In exchange, federal prosecutors will drop the civil rights charges and a second perjury charge. Under the agreement, Schwartz could serve as little as 3 years in prison. Outside the courtroom, Abner Louima lamented that Schwartz was getting off without taking full responsibility for his role. Dred Scott Keyes files this report from New York City.
Schwartz served 33 months of a 15-year sentence after he was convicted in 1999 of depriving Abner Louima of his civil rights by restraining him as another officer, Justin Volpe, sodomized the Haitian immigrant in the bathroom of Brooklyn's 70th Precinct in August of 1997. Schwartz was later convicted in federal court, along with two other officers, for lying about his role in the assault. Meanwhile, Volpe pled guilty and was sentenced to 30 years in jail. Schwartz maintained that he was innocent, as his wife hosted fundraisers and made an appearance on the television news magazine 60 Minutes seeking sympathy for her husband. In February of this year, a federal appeals court overturned his conviction, vacated the conspiracy charge, and ordered a new civil rights trial. In March, a federal grand jury indicted Schwartz on perjury charges, and during the July trial, a federal jury convicted Schwartz on perjury but deadlocked on the more serious civil rights charges. Later that month, a federal judge ordered that he be retried, the fifth trial for Schwartz stemming from the Louima case. The court's reasons for this weekend's deal, says Newsday columnist Jimmy Breslin, were weak.
They say they're afraid of it. One juror hanging them up. It's beautiful. It's the democracy. You're supposed to fear, not do anything based on a fear. You have no confidence that the people are legitimate citizens. If you give them the evidence, they might make the right choice, as they did in two previous trials, plus most of the jurors on the third. The next thing was that the public shouldn't have to go through this again. The city is so tired of this case. It's exhausting. What are they talking about? It's a Nazi torture in the middle of Brooklyn. Get the answer. I don't care if it takes 10 trials.
Breslin seems puzzled as to how the jury became deadlocked when there was overwhelming evidence that Schwartz was present during the sodomizing of Louima.
One woman who was nuts from the start, a German woman, they called her Fräulein. She wouldn't argue with them. She wouldn't talk to them. She wouldn't discuss anything. How she got past the judge in the questioning of prospective jurors, I don't know. It was a bad job by the judge. At any rate, the woman got on the jury, and here she was. And she held it all up into a mistrial.
The people of New York City were robbed, says Breslin, of real justice.
There was committed in our midst a Nazi crime. And the public is supposed to get an answer and get it resolved. Somebody has to be punished and punished thoroughly and convincingly for that crime. You don't half punish. You don't one-third punish. You don't one-fifth. You don't get squeamish. You go. Listen, that happened in the city of New York, really in front of you. And you're supposed to make a deal? Crazy. It's not done. Compromise? What, compromise on a crime by Nazis? Never.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
As a mock state of emergency drill was conducted yesterday at Indian Point 2 nuclear power plant north of New York City, a group of activists demonstrated on the steps of New York City Hall to warn of what they see as the real dangers posed by the plant. Nadja Middleton reports.
The drill at Indian Point involved day-long attempts by plant workers to contain an imaginary small leak of radioactivity. In the event of a leak, the entire population within a 10-mile radius of the plant is to be evacuated. But critics of the Radiological Emergency Preparedness Plan say it is flawed. Elizabeth Shanklin is with the New York City campaign to close Indian Point.
This plan does not include or make any provision for the residents or people who work in New York City. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has held that the peak fatality and injury zone around Indian Point is a 50-mile radius. Except for the southern tip of Staten Island, all of New York City falls within the peak fatality and injury zone. One hit on the irradiated fuel pool and 21 million people will either be dead or contaminated, and the financial center of this country destroyed.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Federal Emergency Management Agency oversaw yesterday's drill and are expected to give a preliminary report Friday. But Linda Lewis, a USDA Radiological Emergency Preparedness Plan evaluator, says the public needs to seriously question any evacuation plan approved by these federal agencies.
Those who conduct the evaluations have indicated widespread fear of fully and accurately reporting any problems they observe. And I myself have experienced a whole series of retaliations that began after I reported the cover-up of problems at a Salem nuclear power plant in Delaware in 1996. After I became known as a whistleblower for that disclosure and other disclosures, my peers who evaluate radiological exercises increasingly came to me saying that not only were they afraid to truthfully report problems, but most of all of the people they knew were afraid.
Lewis says, without justification, she has been forced to go on administrative leave. She says to enforce public safety, whistleblower protection is essential, including for the employees of the new Homeland Security Agency. Critics charge the Bush administration, however, hopes to not only limit workers' rights in the new agency, but has also proposed to expand on the 20% of nuclear energy the United States already uses. Since the September 11th attacks, environmentalist calls to decommission Indian Point have been echoed by an increasing number of local residents, including politicians, who fear no amount of drilling can guarantee the protection of the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nadja Middleton in New York.
For well over a decade, the Pacific Lumber Company has been the focus of sharp criticism for its logging practices on the north coast of California. When the company was taken over by the Houston-based Maxim Corporation, it increased the pace of logging in its old-growth redwood forests. Massive demonstrations in the early 90s resulted in the federal and state purchase of the Headwaters Forest. That did not, however, end the controversial logging practices on its remaining holdings, which some say have only gotten worse. And so the protests continue. The latest controversy has inspired 13 young women to occupy the upper branches of 13 old-growth trees. Estelle Fennell has more.
On Monday, defiance and resistance were the messages of the day as a crowd rallied in support of two long-term tree sits and learned of the new ones going up. The crowd, composed of local residents from every walk of life, Earth First Direct Action activists, and other environmental activists, was especially angered by the news that Pacific Lumber continues to cut trees at a fast pace. This despite a court order issued August 29th that they say prohibits the company from logging until a lawsuit filed 3 years ago goes to trial. This is just one in a long series of PL transgressions, according to Dr. Ken Miller, a local resident who's become active in his watershed association.
We've been involved with the local residents in the watersheds, and we've been involved with developing our own science, monitoring the streams. And what we have discovered over the past 5 or 6 years is that there's a very common theme underlying Maxam Pacific Lumber's operations. And that theme can be described in two words, and that's fraud and corruption.
Corruption, he says, because the company maintains, despite a clarification made September 19th by the judge in question, that the stay does not extend to current timber harvest. And he and others believe Maxam Pacific Lumber holds sway over regulatory agencies such as the California Department of Forestry and the Department of Fish and Game, who defer to the company's reading of the order. But the company cannot exert influence over its neighbors, Dr. Miller said, and that's something they may not have counted on.
We never give up. We pursue, we rise up, we will never give up.
And that was definitely the attitude of the direct action activists. Remedy, celebrating 6 month anniversary of her tree sit, spoke to the crowd via bullhorn from 180 feet above the ground. She reflected on her determination in the face of being labeled a terrorist.
We're not afraid. We're going to rise up. We're going to protect these trees because they're already poisoning the water. Cutting down trees and building more cars is a very bad combination. And so I really feel like in a lot of senses, we don't have anything to lose. We must do this. I feel like it's my responsibility to do this, and that's why I'm here.
And activist Julia Butterfly Hill, whose own tree sit of over 2 years on Pacific Lumber land made world headlines, was also there to lend her support.
We look throughout history and we know that the greatest changes have happened when people were willing to put their bodies where their beliefs are, when people stand up and say enough is enough.
And with attorneys for the Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC, who brought the lawsuit, still waiting for more clarification from the judge, Cynthia Elkins of EPIC said this latest issue could prove very costly to Maxam and its shareholders.
We think, honestly, that they are putting themselves in a very precarious position because at this point they're opening themselves up to contempt charges, to challenges under the Unfair Business Practice Act, which carries with it very stiff penalties. And so we think that anyone who is invested in Maxam at this point should be very concerned about that investment, and that the Pacific Lumber is acting irresponsibly from a business economic standpoint as well as from the environmental standpoint.
For Free Speech Radio News in Humboldt County, this is Estelle Fennell with KMUD.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mester, with production assistance by Scott Gurian. Headlines editor is Randy Zimmerman, and Jade Paget-Seekins is our technical producer. We have technical assistance from Pauline Bartolone, web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Shelley, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Julie Hay.